This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 923 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine and Lebanon. In Gaza, 8 Palestinians were killed and nearly 30 were wounded in Israeli attacks over a 24-hour period between Tuesday and Wednesday, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. On Tuesday night, at least 5 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli strike on the Beach refugee camp in Gaza City. The Electronic Intifada's contributor, photojournalist Mohammed Assad, posted this report to his social media from the funeral march in the beach camp on Wednesday.
There really a ceasefire agreement in Gaza?
There is a false image among the people around the world that ceasefire is in place in Gaza, but in reality, what's happening only reduction of the intensity of the violence. Instead of killing 100 of two or 200 Palestinians in the day, Israeli forces are now killing between 5 and 10 Palestinians daily. The heartbreaking scenes and continuous funerals are happening every day. Children are being killed, women are being killed, and young are being killed. Mothers crying over their children and loved ones, and not an exception. It is a daily reality. This is also happening among the rising tensions in the Middle East, particularly related to the Iran front. As the global attention shifts to other regions, Israeli forces are taking advantage of this and continue to carry out these violations on a daily basis.
That was Mohammed Assad in Gaza. Just hours before Tuesday's attack on the Beach refugee camp, Israel carried out a strike on a vehicle in Gaza City, killing a police officer and 3 bystanders, one of whom was a 3-year-old boy, Yahya al-Malahi. Reporter Saad Hezbollah captured footage of Yahya's father, Mukhlis al-Malahi, in agonizing shock and grief, cradling the body of his toddler whose head is split in half, with blood all over both of their clothes. He told reporters that they were leaving a relative's wedding when an Israeli plane attacked the police car. The boy's cousin told Reuters, quote, "What is his fault? What is his crime? He should be wearing a wedding suit at his cousin's today, but instead he wore a shroud stained with blood." Israeli fire also killed a 14-year-old child, Ahmed Halawa, near Jabalia in the north, according to health ministry officials. On Monday, April 13th, Israeli forces bombed a cafe in Gaza City, targeting Palestinians who were sitting inside. Reporter Mahmoud Shalha covered the scene as people pulled bodies from the rubble by hand. In northern Gaza, 10-year-old Abdullah Dawas was shot in the head and killed by an Israeli quadcopter drone on April 11th, according to reporter Maha Husseini. Husseini said that at least 8 Palestinians had been killed in a series of Israeli attacks across Gaza on Sunday. On April 10th, at least 6 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza. The Gaza government media office stated on Tuesday that in the 6 months since the so-called ceasefire was declared, Israel has killed more than 750 Palestinians, injured 2,100, and committed approximately 2,400 violations. Of those violations, Israel has committed more than 1,100 incidents of shelling and targeted strikes, hundreds of incidents involving the demolition of homes and other buildings, and nearly 100 incursions into residential neighborhoods and areas. Meanwhile, Israel continues to use food, medicine, medical supplies, and fuel as weapons, with its draconian blockade of humanitarian aid firmly in place. The Gaza government media office affirmed this week that Gaza is, quote, being subjected to a systematic, deliberate, and escalating process of engineered starvation perpetrated by the Israeli occupation. This is being executed through the complete control of the flow of basic commodities, foremost among them flour and bread, thereby posing a direct threat to the food security of the people in the Gaza Strip. Gaza requires around 450 tons of flour per day, the office stated, but only about 200 tons are currently available, quote, creating a severe daily deficit. Despite the ceasefire agreement, which requires 600 aid trucks per day, only around 200 have been allowed in on average, leaving shelter supplies, medical aid, and food items almost non-existent, reports Maha Husseini in Middle East Eye. This comes on the heels of a claim made by Nikolai Mladenov, envoy to Donald Trump's Board of Peace, that 602 trucks entered Gaza on April 9th, quote, with essential supplies for families who have waited too long. Mladenov's statement, the Gaza Media Office said, quote, lacks accuracy and credibility, and it contradicts documented facts on the ground. Actual data for April 9th, 2026, confirms the entry of only 207 trucks, 79 of which were aid trucks. This falls far short of the required level of humanitarian response and in no way reflects expanded access, as was alleged, particularly given that the rate of compliance with truck entry protocols since the commencement of the ceasefire has not exceeded 38% of the agreed-upon target. The media office noted that Mladenov's deliberate misinformation, quote, raises fundamental questions. Where is the so-called Board of Peace amidst the Israeli occupation's daily violations of the agreement? Why does it remain silent? And furthermore, where does it stand regarding the public pledges it made before the international community to protect the Gaza Strip in light of a catastrophic and worsening humanitarian reality? Medical Aid for Palestinians, a British charity, this week warned of the ongoing shortages of basic medications and medical supplies across Gaza. More than 53% of essential medicines are at zero stock, medical workers say, including 64% of cancer medications. Around 70% of medical laboratories have stopped functioning because of the lack of supplies, and 90 hospital generators are out of service due to spare parts and oil being blocked by Israel. Medical Aid for Palestinians says that approximately half of all hospitals remain non-functional, and there are still no fully functional hospitals in Gaza at all. MAP says that their teams, quote, can't find even the essential medicines they need. That says everything about how aid is coming in. Euromed Human Rights Monitor released a comprehensive report this week on Israel's de facto state policy of sexual violence against Palestinians in Israeli prisons and detention centers. The report, titled Another Genocide Behind Walls, documents widespread patterns of sexual violence, including rape, against detainees from the Gaza Strip, describing it as a tool of destruction aimed at breaking individual and collective will and inflicting severe physical and psychological harm. And just a note to our listeners, the following excerpts from the report contain descriptions of sexual violence. The report cites direct sexual assault, assault with objects, and torture targeting the genitals, as well as organized practices such as filming and the presence of multiple security personnel during assaults, which reinforces evidence of the institutional and systematic nature of these crimes. The report, Euromed adds, quote, relied primarily on live testimonies from Palestinian former detainees from the Gaza Strip who were released by Israeli forces in recent weeks and months and who reported being subjected to various forms of systematic sexual violence. Testimonies documented by the group, quote, confirm that forcing prisoners and detainees to witness sexual violence against others in Israeli detention centers was a frequent and deliberate practice. This formed part of psychological abuse and complex torture designed to create a collective impact, turn the victim's body into a tool for terrorizing detainees, break their will, and produce collective helplessness. In this context, rape and sexual assault were not only committed in secret, but in documented cases, were staged as a public spectacle in courtyards and shared cells. Detainees were forced to line up or remain within direct view while others were assaulted, making the act of witnessing itself a structural component of the crime rather than a mere circumstance. This practice consisted of repeated collective humiliation rituals designed to dehumanize detainees in front of each other. Techniques included collective forced nudity, crowding detainees naked, using obscenities, and breaching social norms, such as stripping men in front of women and children, or threatening women with rape while their husbands watched. The goal was to break family bonds and create a sense of helplessness, impacting both the victims and the witnesses. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces fired tear gas at a group of children trying to get to their school in Masafariyata, south of Al-Khalil, on April 13th. Mohamed Horeini, a resident of Masafariyata and an activist, recorded a rampage by Jewish Israeli settlers into his village of Tuani on April 13th. He said, "Settlers stormed lands in my village, Tuani, in Masafariyata, bringing their sheep onto our property under the full view of the Israeli army and police. Palestinians were forcibly driven off their own land, while settlers were allowed to roam freely without any restraint. As if this was not enough, they escalated the violence by firing tear gas and stun grenades directly at us." To make matters worse, one of the residents was arrested simply in response to the settlers' demands. This is not just harassment. It is a systematic policy of intimidation and dispossession carried out in broad daylight with complete impunity. That's from Mohamed Horeini in Masafariyata. Meanwhile, my colleague Tamara Nassar reports this week that Israel is establishing facts on the ground in the occupied West Bank faster than ever before. She writes that, quote, "In March, Israel's so-called security cabinet covertly approved the establishment of 34 new settlements, not units, entire settlements in the West Bank. News of this decision only became public last week after being kept confidential by the cabinet when it was approved, reportedly in an effort to avoid backlash from the United States during negotiations for a ceasefire with Iran. This is Israel's largest ever colonial expansion," said Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, on April 9th. "This is the largest ethnic cleansing and land grab in Palestine since the Nakba. It's happening under our watch," she continued. Tamara notes that before the current government took power in 2022, there were 127 recognized Israeli settlements in the West Bank, according to the Israeli group Peace Now, which monitors settlement activity. The newly approved 34 settlements would add to 68 that the government has already advanced since its formation, bringing the total number of settlements approved under this administration to 102, Peace Now added. This is roughly an 80% increase of all settlements in the West Bank advanced under this government alone. These developments are taking place against a backdrop of accelerating settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank, Tamara writes. At least 37 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far in 2026, at least 10 of them by settlers. Tamara adds that, quote, "whether through de facto or de jure annexation, the Israeli objective has always been the same. The underlying logic of Zionism, as it is with any colonial movement, is the expansion of settlements and the displacement of the indigenous population to replace them with colonial settlers. Every Israeli front, whether in Gaza, the West Bank, or elsewhere, is ultimately rooted in that objective," Tamara writes. For much more, read Tamara Nassar's report, "Israel's Largest Land Grab Since the Nakba," on electronicintifada.net. Turning to Lebanon, Israeli attacks across the country have killed more than 2,100 people and have injured approximately 7,000 since March 2nd. A week ago, on April 8th, as we reported, Israel hit Beirut in a barrage of strikes that killed more than 300 people within minutes. Speaking to Al-Mayadeen, Dr. Ghassan Aboussita, who is currently working in the hospital at the American University of Beirut, said that Israel's attacks were deliberately designed to overwhelm the country's healthcare system and maximize deaths. The following is from Al-Mayadeen's report. Quote, in a period of 10 minutes, over 1,400 people were wounded and 340 were killed, Aboussita said. The aim is to flood the system, to overwhelm it, and to ensure that as many of the wounded die. He said that the scale and speed of the strikes collapsed emergency response capacity from the outset, leaving ambulance services and hospitals unable to cope with the volume of casualties. Hospitals rapidly exhausted intensive care capacity, including pediatric units, while smaller facilities were forced to transfer patients under life-threatening delays. Quote, we ran out of intensive care beds. We ran out of pediatric intensive care capacity, he said. The smaller hospitals were overwhelmed, and the delays in transferring patients cost lives. That day was the first day that felt like a day in Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, he said. Children came in with no names, no surviving families. Nobody knew who anybody was. The scenes, he added, triggered immediate psychological recall. You find yourself thinking, not this again. For more on the aftermath of the April 8th attacks and the current situation in Lebanon, our contributor Rokaya Chemsedine filed this report for the Electronic Intifada on Wednesday evening.
I'm Rokaya Chemsedine, reporting for the Electronic Intifada. It has been 1 week since what has come to be known as Black Wednesday, a devastating Israeli assault that in the span of roughly 10 minutes killed more than 300 people across Beirut and its southern suburbs. The coordinated wave of strikes carved through densely populated neighborhoods, marking one of the bloodiest days in Lebanon's recent history. As of this recording, dozens are still missing and believed to be trapped beneath the rubble, while at least 15 unidentified bodies remain in refrigerated units at Rafiq al-Hariri University Hospital in Beirut, a stark and ongoing testament to the scale of devastation. In the southern Lebanese city of Bint Jbin, Hezbollah resistance fighters continue to mount a fierce defense against ongoing Israeli attempts to seize the strategically significant location, engaging invading forces in sustained, close-range confrontations that have reportedly resulted in mounting losses. Local sources describe near daily helicopter evacuations from the outskirts of the city, with Israeli troops being transported north towards medical facilities across the border, including Rambam Medical Center and occupied Haifa. In other areas of South Lebanon, first responders continue to face Israeli airstrikes, including most recently in the town of Mayfalun, where three paramedics, Fed al-Sarhan, Mahdi Abu Zaid, and Ali Sabra, were killed after their ambulances were intentionally targeted by Israeli forces as they attempted to tend to a previous Israeli attack. Also this week, even as Israel continues to attack towns across southern Lebanon and kill dozens of Lebanese citizens, Lebanese government representatives sat across from Israeli officials in Washington in what was presented as a peace initiative brokered by U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The meeting brought together Lebanon's ambassador Neda Mu'awad and Israeli envoy Yechiel Leiter, marking a rare direct engagement, but one that unfolded under the shadow of ongoing bombardment. The shared demands of the meeting reportedly centered on the disarmament of Hezbollah and the imposition of a new security reality in the south, effectively stripping Lebanon of its only meaningful line of defense. The timing and substance of these talks have provoked sharp backlash on the ground, where they are widely viewed as capitulation and as an effort by the Lebanese political class to do through negotiations what cannot be achieved on the battlefield, that is, to forcibly strip Hezbollah of its right to resist and thereby dismantle the country's only credible deterrent against Israeli aggression. As resistance fighters continue to confront Israeli forces in places like Bint Jbin, the contrast is stark. A government engaging in negotiations from a position of weakness while the battlefield itself continues to impose limits on Israeli advances.
That was Rokaya Chemsedine reporting for the Electronic Intifada from Lebanon on Wednesday. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Women Recount Abuse at Hands of Israeli Military by Ahud Nassar, writing from Gaza. Nassar profiles two women, Sharifa Kudih and Saja Abdel-Al, who she says reveal some of what women have endured during Israeli military incursions into Gaza's neighborhoods, a trajectory that begins but does not end with airstrikes and displacement. In a narrow corridor inside a government school that has been converted into a shelter in the city of Khan Yunus in Gaza's south, Sharifa Kudih, 50, sits on a piece of cardboard while families pass endlessly around her. Unmarried and with no children to care for, this corridor is all that remains, she said, after her home in the town of Abasan al-Kabira, east of Khan Yunus, was destroyed. In February 2024, Sharifa said, around 5:30 a.m., she was asleep in her home when it was bombed. I woke up to a massive explosion and then found myself under the rubble, she said. She was not badly injured, but was trapped beneath the debris for nearly 2 hours before invading Israeli troops heard her and pulled her out. When they took me out, I thought I was going to die or be taken prisoner, she said. Instead, she told the Electronic Intifada, the soldiers ordered her to remove her hijab, the scarf covering her hair, and tied her hands. Then they questioned her. They asked me why I was in the house and about names of people. I didn't know any of them. Soldiers sat her on a chair on her own devastated land as they continued their operations. Sharifa said the soldiers then used her as a human shield alongside a group of young men. They forced us to walk in front of them, she said. Human rights organizations have documented hundreds of cases in which the Israeli military broke international law, including using women and children as human shields. Photos were taken of Sharifa while she was seated on a chair on a mound of earth with Israeli soldiers crouching behind her, apparently combat ready. She only discovered this later when an Israeli soldier received an award for the photo, which was apparently taken by drone, and said she gave no consent and was not asked for any. I was shocked when acquaintances sent me a photo of myself displayed in a gallery in Tel Aviv. I had no idea they had photographed me. After the soldiers finished with her, they let her go, a surveillance drone monitoring her from above, she said. She had to walk over rubble for more than an hour to get away from the area and to safety. Sharifa now lives in the corridor of the government school in Khan Yunus. She has neither a mattress nor a blanket. She sleeps like she sits on a piece of cardboard that was distributed as humanitarian aid. Her home was completely destroyed, and she has nowhere else to go. Those are excerpts from Women Recount Abuse at Hands of Israeli Military by Ahud Nassar, a journalist and teacher writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. Photographer Samer Abu Samra captured video of a volleyball game in northern Gaza this week. Abu Samra writes, quote, "In the Jabalia refugee camp, at the Abu Hussein school, and on the yellow line, from the school's rubble, we make life. We play and dream, and we believe that hope is not defeated." And two children in Gaza, Mira and Ahed, whose parents post videos of them on social media, sang a love song to their sweet tea with mint. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.